In 1971, William Peter Blatty unleashed a cultural earthquake with The Exorcist, a novel so viscerally terrifying that readers reportedly fainted while reading it. The book sold over 13 million copies worldwide and spent 57 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, with 17 of those at number one. When adapted to film in 1973, it became the first horror movie nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. What made this tale of demonic possession so powerful wasn't just its shocking imagery, but its profound exploration of faith, doubt, and the nature of evil in modern society. Stanley Kubrick called it the scariest book I've ever read, while Stephen King credited it with revolutionizing horror literature. The Vatican even maintains an official corps of exorcists today, with requests for exorcisms rising dramatically in recent decades, a phenomenon many attribute to the cultural impact of Blatty's masterwork. Beyond mere horror, The Exorcist continues to challenge readers with its central question: in a world of scientific explanation, what do we make of the inexplicable? The novel opens with a sense of foreboding in the scorching Iraqi desert, where an elderly archaeologist sits at a roadside tea house, haunted by an unshakable premonition. Though his archaeological dig is complete, he senses something far more ominous is just beginning. This feeling intensifies when he visits the Mosul Museum and becomes fixated on an amulet, a green stone head of the demon Pazuzu that traditionally wards off sickness. Despite the curator's warning not to return to America, the man feels compelled to visit the ruins of Nineveh one last time. Standing among ancient temples near a limestone statue of Pazuzu, he suddenly comprehends what troubles him. As a southwest wind rises across the desert, he hurries back toward Mosul, certain he will soon face an ancient enemy. This prologue masterfully establishes the novel's central tension between the ancient and modern worlds. Blatty immediately signals that this story will bridge two seemingly incompatible realities, the contemporary, scientific Western worldview and the ancient belief in supernatural forces. The archaeologist represents modern man's rational approach to history and artifacts, yet he's overwhelmed by intuition and premonition, forces beyond rational explanation. The mention of Pazuzu is particularly significant, as this Mesopotamian demon was believed to bring famine and disease, but could also be invoked to drive away other evil spirits. This duality, that something terrifying might also serve as protection, foreshadows the complex moral and theological questions the novel will explore. The southwest wind rising at the ruins creates an atmospheric connection between ancient evil and the Georgetown setting where most of the story unfolds. By beginning in Iraq rather than Washington, D.C., Blatty immediately globalizes his narrative, suggesting that what we're about to witness transcends cultural and geographical boundaries. Evil, the prologue implies, is not confined to any single belief system or historical period. It is universal and eternal, waiting to manifest when conditions are right. Before the horror begins, Blatty establishes the McNeil household as a relatively normal, if somewhat unconventional, family unit. Chris McNeil, a successful actress filming in Georgetown, lives with her 12-year-old daughter Regan, their secretary Sharon, and their household staff Carl and Willie. The early scenes depict the comfortable rhythms of their lives, Chris investigating strange knocking sounds in the attic, playing pranks on the stoic Carl, and taking Regan sightseeing around Washington, D.C. These ordinary moments serve a crucial purpose. They establish the normal that will soon be shattered. At Arlington Cemetery, Regan unexpectedly asks why people have to die and mentions God, surprising her atheist mother who never taught religion at home. This innocent question foreshadows the profound theological crisis that will soon engulf them all. Chris learns that Sharon has been discussing God with Regan and reluctantly tells her daughter that God gets lonesome for us rather than sharing her true beliefs, a small dishonesty that hints at Chris's complicated relationship with faith. Regan's birthday celebration marks the last moment of normalcy. Her father, Howard, fails to call, claiming to be unreachable on a yacht, an absence that suggests the emotional vulnerability that might make Regan susceptible to what follows. That night, Regan retreats to the basement playroom, and the next morning, Chris wakes to find her daughter in her bed, claiming, "My bed was shaking," the first subtle indication that something unnatural has entered their lives. Blatty carefully constructs these scenes to establish Chris as a loving but secular mother, raising her daughter in a world where rationality prevails and supernatural explanations are dismissed. The absence of Regan's father creates an emotional void, while the introduction of religious concepts by Sharon plants seeds that will grow into terrifying questions about the nature of good and evil. Most importantly, these early scenes make us care deeply about Regan and Chris, investing us emotionally in the nightmare that's about to unfold. The contrast between their comfortable Georgetown home and the ancient evil foreshadowed in the prologue creates dramatic tension. We know something terrible is coming, but like Chris, we can't imagine how completely it will destroy the boundaries between the rational and supernatural worlds. While the McNeil household faces its first hints of trouble, Father Damien Karas struggles through a profound spiritual crisis. A Jesuit priest with psychiatric training, Karas stands on a subway platform wrestling with overwhelming doubt. When approached by a drunken derelict claiming to be Catholic, he offers financial help but avoids deeper engagement, secretly relieved to board his train and escape the encounter. Karas's crisis is multifaceted. At Fordham University, he delivers a paper on psychological aspects of spiritual development, highlighting the intersection of his religious vocation and scientific training. This duality becomes crucial as the story progresses. He is both priest and psychiatrist, uniquely positioned between faith and science, yet finding himself increasingly alienated from both worlds. His visit to his elderly immigrant mother in her squalid Manhattan apartment reveals another dimension of his suffering. Overwhelmed by guilt for leaving her in such poor conditions, Karas contemplates requesting a transfer to New York. His previous such request was met with understanding but no action, deepening his sense of powerlessness. This relationship with his mother becomes a critical vulnerability that the demon will later exploit with devastating precision. Most significantly, Karas's faith has eroded to near extinction. He questions God's silence in the face of evil and suffering, desperately yearning for some sign of divine presence. When he celebrates Mass alone in his room, he feels only the papery taste of despair as he consumes the host, a devastating image of spiritual emptiness. He returns to Washington carrying pain in a black valise, a man whose vocation has become a hollow shell. Blatty's portrayal of Karas's crisis is remarkable for its psychological depth. Rather than presenting a simple loss of faith, he shows how doubt corrodes Karas from multiple directions. Professional frustration, filial guilt, and theological questioning all converge. The character emerges as a modern-day Job, maintaining the outward forms of his vocation while inwardly crying out to a God who seems absent. This spiritual darkness makes Karas the perfect counterpoint to the possession narrative. As a psychiatrist, he represents the scientific worldview that would explain Regan's condition through psychological and neurological frameworks. As a doubting priest, he embodies the modern religious crisis of faith in a secular age. When these worlds collide in Regan's bedroom, Karas will be forced to confront not just a demon, but his own fractured belief system. Regan's transformation from normal preteen to something unrecognizable begins subtly but accelerates with terrifying speed. By April 11, Chris calls her Los Angeles doctor seeking a psychiatric referral, describing how Regan has become quarrelsome, temperamental, and hyperactive. Most disturbing are the mysterious rappings that occur when Regan is present and her complaints about furniture being moved during the night. The medical investigation begins with Dr. Klein, who diagnoses Regan with hyperkinetic behavior disorder and prescribes Ritalin. He shocks Chris by revealing Regan used obscene language during the examination, behavior completely out of character for the previously sweet-natured girl. Despite faithful medication, Chris notices no improvement and even signs of deterioration, including complaints about a strange smell in Regan's bedroom that only she can detect. A pivotal moment occurs during Chris's dinner party when Regan appears in her nightgown, urinates on the rug, and tells an astronaut guest, "You're going to die up there," in a lifeless voice. This public display marks a significant escalation, suggesting whatever afflicts Regan is growing bolder. After the guests leave, Chris is awakened by Regan's terrified screams and finds her daughter's bed violently shaking, a manifestation that can no longer be dismissed as merely psychological. As medical investigations continue, doctors suspect temporal lobe epilepsy based on Regan's symptoms, the bed shaking, memory lapses, personality changes, hallucinations, hearing Captain Howdy, smelling burning odors, and inappropriate behavior. Dr. Klein explains that historically, people with such disorders were thought to be possessed by demons, the first explicit connection between Regan's condition and supernatural explanations. Despite extensive testing, including EEGs, lumbar punctures, and X-rays, all results come back normal. The medical establishment gradually exhausts its explanatory frameworks, moving from neurological to psychiatric interpretations. When a psychiatrist attempts to hypnotize Regan, the entity inside her emerges with shocking violence, identifying itself as Nauanmai, which readers will later realize is I am no one backward, claiming to hate Regan and wanting to kill her. Blatty's genius lies in how he gradually escalates the horror while maintaining medical and psychological plausibility at each stage. The doctor's shifting diagnoses mirror the reader's own uncertainty. Is this epilepsy, multiple personality disorder, hysteria? By presenting each scientific explanation and then systematically dismantling it, he creates a narrative vacuum that supernatural explanations rush to fill. The medical professionals become unwitting allies in building the case for possession, as their failed treatments demonstrate the inadequacy of purely scientific approaches to Regan's condition. As Regan's condition deteriorates beyond recognition, the medical establishment reaches the limits of its explanatory power. After ruling out physical causes through extensive testing, doctors diagnose her with somnambuliform possession, a psychiatric disorder rarely seen except in primitive cultures where patients believe their bodies have been invaded by alien intelligences. In modern cases, the invading entity is usually someone dead, but Regan's case is more malevolent, with the new personality aiming to damage or destroy the host. The doctor's clinical language attempts to contain the horror within scientific frameworks, but these frameworks begin to buckle under the weight of increasingly inexplicable phenomena. When Chris discovers a crucifix hidden under Regan's pillow that none of the staff admits to placing there, the boundary between medical and supernatural explanations grows increasingly porous. The discovery of a witchcraft book under Regan's bed further suggests forces beyond scientific understanding. The definitive collapse of medical explanation occurs when Chris witnesses Regan spider-walking upside down, her body impossibly arched backward with her head almost touching her feet, hissing like a serpent with her tongue flicking in and out. This physically impossible contortion cannot be explained by any known medical condition, forcing Chris and the reader to consider explanations outside scientific paradigms. The most horrifying manifestation comes when Chris finds Regan using a crucifix to violate herself while a demonic voice bellows from her throat. The demon forces Regan to commit this sacrilegious act while her consciousness appears to be fighting against it, a terrifying demonstration of the entity's control over her body. When Regan's head rotates completely backward on her body, an anatomically impossible contortion, the last vestiges of medical explanation crumble. Meanwhile, Detective Kinderman's investigation into Burke Denning's death reveals that the director's head had been turned completely around, requiring tremendous strength, suggesting Regan, or whatever controls her, murdered him by throwing him from her bedroom window. This connection between Regan's impossible physical contortion and Denning's murder method creates a chilling symmetry that further suggests supernatural agency. Blatty's narrative strategy is masterful. He presents the scientific community earnestly attempting to diagnose and treat Regan, only to have each explanation systematically invalidated by increasingly impossible manifestations. Rather than simply declaring science wrong, he shows it reaching its explanatory limits when confronted with phenomena that transcend its materialist assumptions. This approach respects both scientific methodology and the possibility of realities beyond its scope, a nuanced position that makes the horror all the more convincing. Lieutenant William F. Kinderman enters the narrative as a seemingly bumbling, theatrical detective investigating Burke Denning's death. His odd mannerisms, discussing movies and bacteria while carefully observing the house layout, disguise a shrewd investigator gathering critical information. Though initially claiming his visit is routine, his careful attention to Regan's window overlooking the steps where Denning's died suggests deeper suspicions. Kinderman represents yet another framework attempting to make sense of the events, criminal investigation. Like medicine and psychiatry, detective work assumes rational explanations for human behavior. Yet Kinderman gradually discovers evidence that challenges these assumptions. The pathologist's report confirms Denning's head was turned completely around, an injury nearly impossible from a fall and requiring tremendous strength. This finding connects directly to demonic folklore, as Kinderman later discusses with Father Karras. The detective's investigation broadens to include church desecrations around Georgetown, including a defaced statue and an altar card containing obscene Latin text. When he discovers paint from Regan's sculpture matches that used in the church desecration, he establishes a material connection between the McNeil household and sacrilegious acts, though he doesn't yet understand the supernatural implications. Kinderman's conversations with Father Karras reveal the detective's complexity. Despite his professional obligation to seek rational explanations, he shows surprising openness to supernatural possibilities. Their discussion of black mass, witchcraft covens, and ritual murders suggests Kinderman recognizes dimensions to the case beyond ordinary crime. His awkward but touching invitation for Karras to see a movie reveals his loneliness and desire for connection, humanizing him beyond the detective stereotype. The investigation also reveals Carl's hidden life, his narcotics charge mysteriously dropped, and his secret visits to his drug-addicted daughter, Elvira. These elements initially suggest Carl might be involved in the supernatural events, creating a red herring that diverts suspicion from the true cause. When Kinderman confronts Carl about his false alibi, the detective seems to be closing in on a human perpetrator, maintaining the possibility of a non-supernatural explanation. Blatty uses Kinderman's investigation to create another layer of tension in the narrative. Criminal investigation, like medicine, seeks rational explanations for disturbing events. As evidence mounts that no human agency could explain what's happening to Regan or how Denning's died, Kinderman's framework, like the doctor's, proves inadequate. Yet unlike the medical professionals who retreat when their explanations fail, Kinderman continues pursuing the truth, eventually forming a friendship with Father Dyer that symbolizes the integration of secular and religious worldviews. When Chris McNeil approaches Father Karras about performing an exorcism, she finds a priest uniquely unsuited to the task, a man whose faith has crumbled under the weight of doubt and grief. Yet this very skepticism makes him the perfect investigator to determine whether Regan's condition truly represents possession or merely psychiatric disturbance. Karras approaches the case with scientific rigor, testing Regan's reactions to determine if they match the church's criteria for genuine possession, speaking in languages the subject never studied, clairvoyance, and demonstrating powers beyond the subject's ability and age. When Regan reacts violently to ordinary tap water he claimed was holy water, Kara sees evidence of suggestibility rather than genuine demonic presence. His investigation deepens when he records Regan speaking in what appears to be an unintelligible language. Taking the tapes to the Institute of Languages and Linguistics, he discovers two crucial findings. The type-token ratio suggests the different voices might be the same personality, and the gibberish is actually English played backward. This backward-speaking ability seems extraordinary, but Karas finds parallels in psychological literature about the unconscious mind's capabilities. The turning point comes when Karas witnesses words appearing on Regan's chest in raised, blood-red script, "Help me," in Regan's own handwriting. This manifestation, combined with other evidence, including Regan's knowledge of Carl's daughter's death and her speaking in languages she never studied, gradually erodes Karas' skepticism. Though still harboring doubts, he requests permission for an exorcism from Georgetown's president, then presents his case to the bishop. Karas' journey from doubt to belief mirrors the reader's own progression through the narrative. As a psychiatrist, he represents the modern scientific worldview that seeks rational explanations for all phenomena. His gradual acceptance of supernatural possibilities creates a bridge for readers to follow, making the possession narrative more credible because it has convinced even this most skeptical observer. The bishop and Georgetown's president decide to bring in Father Lancaster Merrin as the lead exorcist, with Karas assisting. Merrin, recently returned from an archaeological dig near Nineveh, connecting to the novel's prologue, has previous experience with exorcism, a case in Africa that lasted for months and damn near killed him. This decision acknowledges Karas' limitations while setting the stage for the final confrontation between priestly faith and demonic power. Karas' transformation from doubter to believer represents the novel's central spiritual journey. His crisis of faith makes him vulnerable to the demon's psychological attacks, but also gives his eventual commitment more power. When he finally challenges the demon directly, "Come on, loser, try me. Leave the girl and take me," he makes the ultimate sacrifice, offering himself in Regan's place in an act of Christ-like substitution that redeems both his faith and his priesthood. The exorcism itself represents the novel's climactic confrontation between good and evil, faith and doubt, sacrifice and selfishness. Though we don't see the entire ritual, we witness its devastating conclusion as Karas, enraged by the demon's mockery of Marin's corpse, challenges the entity to leave Regan and take him instead. This sacrificial act, "Come on, loser, try me, leave the girl and take me," results in the demon transferring to Karas, who then hurls himself through Regan's window to his death on the steps below. This moment of self-sacrifice transforms the novel from horror story to redemptive tragedy. Karas, whose faith had been all but extinguished, makes the ultimate Christ-like sacrifice, offering himself to save an innocent. The demon's transfer to him and his subsequent suicide serve dual purposes, destroying the demon's vessel while simultaneously demonstrating the power of sacrificial love over demonic hatred. As Chris and Sharon rush to Regan's room, they find Merrin dead on the floor and Karas crumpled at the bottom of the steps outside. Most significantly, they hear a small, tearful voice, "Mother?" Turning, Chris discovers Regan, her real daughter, returned, confused and frightened. The possession has ended, though at terrible cost. Father Dyer administers last rites to the dying Karas, and a tear rolls down Karas's cheek as his eyes fill with mysterious peace and something like joy before he dies. This tear represents the restoration of Karas' faith. In his final moments, he experiences the divine presence he had so desperately sought throughout his spiritual crisis. 6 weeks later, as Chris prepares to leave Georgetown with Reagan, Detective Kinderman concludes that Karras's mind had snapped under guilt and exhaustion, maintaining a rational explanation even in the face of overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Father Dyer refuses to accept this explanation, recognizing the spiritual dimension of Karras's sacrifice. Before their departure, Chris confesses to Father Dyer that she now believes in the devil but questions God's existence. Dyer gently challenges her logic. If all the evil in the world makes you think there might be a devil, then how do you account for all the good in the world? This question encapsulates the novel's theological heart. Evil's existence paradoxically suggests good's reality as well. As they part, Reagan, who remembers nothing of her possession, impulsively kisses Dyer, staring oddly at his collar. This small gesture suggests some subconscious memory or spiritual connection remains, though her conscious mind has mercifully forgotten the ordeal. The novel concludes with Kinderman arriving too late to say goodbye to Chris and Reagan, but inviting Dyer to a movie, beginning what appears to be a new friendship. As they walk arm in arm down the street, joking about films, Kinderman quotes from Casablanca, "Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship." This ending suggests healing and connection after trauma, as the representatives of secular authority, Kinderman, and spiritual faith, Dyer, find common ground. The Exorcist transcends conventional horror by confronting profound theological and philosophical questions about the nature of evil, faith, and redemption in the modern world. While its graphic depictions of possession and exorcism have made it infamous, the novel's deeper power lies in how it challenges readers to confront the limitations of purely materialist worldviews. The central theological tension emerges from the contrast between Chris McNeil's atheism and the undeniable supernatural events she witnesses. Her journey from skepticism to belief in the devil while still questioning God's existence mirrors modern society's selective acceptance of spiritual realities. As Father Dyer points out, her logic is inconsistent. If evil's existence suggests a devil, shouldn't good's existence suggest God? Similarly, Father Karras's crisis of faith represents the modern religious dilemma, maintaining religious identity while struggling with doubt in an increasingly secular world. His psychiatric training gives him scientific explanations for phenomena once attributed to supernatural causes. Yet these explanations ultimately fail to account for Regan's condition. Karras must reconcile his scientific knowledge with experiences that transcend materialist frameworks, a reconciliation that costs him his life but restores his faith. The novel also explores how evil operates in the world. The demon doesn't simply possess Regan, it systematically isolates her by driving away potential helpers, exploits the vulnerabilities of those around her, particularly Karras's guilt about his mother, and desecrates religious symbols to challenge faith. This portrayal suggests evil works not just through spectacular possession, but through subtle corruption of relationships and institutions. Perhaps most powerfully, The Exorcist confronts the problem of innocent suffering. Regan, an innocent child, endures unimaginable horror through no fault of her own. This seemingly senseless suffering challenges traditional theological explanations and forces characters to confront the limits of human understanding. Karras's sacrificial act provides not an intellectual answer, but a moral response to this suffering, demonstrating that love and self-sacrifice remain meaningful even in the face of inexplicable evil. The novel's enduring power comes from refusing easy answers to these questions. It neither dismisses supernatural explanations as superstition, nor presents faith as simple or untroubled. Instead, it creates a space where scientific, criminal, psychiatric, and religious frameworks all attempt to make sense of events that ultimately transcend complete human understanding. In our contemporary world, where scientific materialism often claims exclusive explanatory power, The Exorcist continues to challenge readers with its central question: what if there are realities beyond what our dominant frameworks can explain? This question makes the novel not just terrifying, but philosophically and theologically significant, a horror story that forces us to confront the boundaries of our understanding and the possibility of transcendent good and evil.